Welcome to part two of our interview with Peter Humphrey. We pick up with Peter on the day of his arrest, his time in jail, and the sham of a trial that he and his wife went through. We hope you enjoy the show. It's going to be a tough one to listen to. Just a word of warning.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the view of Wolfpack Research or any of its officers. The views and opinions expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on this program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. We are not investment advisors. We hold no registrations with the SEC, FINRA, or any other regulatory agency, and none of the opinions expressed on this podcast should be considered investment advice. Listeners should assume that we have positions in and stand to benefit from any stock or other security mentioned on this podcast. Do your own research before making investment decisions.
My wife was evidently taken separately and made to sit in our private office, where both of us had desks and had our laptops and so forth. She was made to sit there. So from that moment on, we were separated. We didn't get to see each other properly and discuss anything for the next 2 years.
Oh, no.
And there wasn't much interrogation in the office. Because the bedroom door was left at least half open, maybe fully open, I could see what was going on out in the main office space. And it was basically dozens of PSB people, plainclothes, occupying all of the desks, all of the workstations, going through all of the computers without doing any proper forensic imaging, ransacking drawers, forcing open filing cabinets, basically going. None of this was very forensic. And that's one of the first things that struck me about this, is that this raid was not.
Is that unusual there? I mean, we don't know whether that's unusual there or not.
I can tell you why. Okay. You know, you would expect them to be careful, bag and tag, take photographs of an open door before they start touching the stuff inside it, things like that. Right. They didn't do any of that. And they were not forensically imaging the computers before they started rummaging in the computers. So they were contaminating any evidence that there was there on the computers. And I realized that this is because they knew what they were looking for. They didn't care about anything except the things that they were looking for. Ah. And I heard mutterings about GSK, the company name, and which in Chinese is Golan Suke, right? So I realized then that they were actually looking for our GSK files.
And they had your passwords already.
I don't know how they did that. I've got no idea whether they had passwords or whether
How else would you do it? If you just get in there and you start operating, you've got
IT. Good IT. I mean, you can get around. You can bypass
that quickly, huh? Okay. Did they present you with a warrant? Do they have that kind of thing there?
No. They did not show a warrant. There was a kind of eureka moment, which I remember hearing, where, you know, somebody exclaimed that they'd found something that they were looking for, which would have been our GSK case files. And then there was another eureka moment when they found some telephone roaming analysis report on Excel spreadsheets on my laptop, because you couldn't really do that then, but in some previous years, it was possible to get sight of roaming data on an investigation subject, and analyze that data to look for connections between your suspected fraudster and other people in the workplace, for example.
Telephone roaming, you said.
Yeah, mobile phone roaming, right. And this one was some years old, but that was a eureka moment, because they went to say, what's this doing on your computer? This is illegal. And it was actually from a time when it wasn't illegal. So this went on for a couple of hours. And at 9 o'clock onwards, gradually our staff were trickling in. They were being, as soon as they came in, they went into our conference room and made to sit in silence around our conference table.
That seems bizarre to me, Peter, that your staff would be trickling in. Wouldn't they see like 30 police officers and say, oh, gee, I forgot something at home, and leave?
No, they were not allowed to leave. No.
Okay.
They were kept there all day. They were eventually questioned. But obviously, there's a lot that we didn't see that was going on as well. And after 2 hours, Ying and I were both taken away separately. As we left, we could see all our staff seated around this conference table, looking very, very shocked. And we were taken out of the building separately in separate lifts and away in separate cars. Police had a bunch of cars at the basement of the building.
And you never spoke again for 2 years?
We did speak briefly before the trial.
Okay.
And after 6 months, we were allowed to actually exchange letters. But that day, from the office, they took us to a building called 803, which is the Shanghai Criminal Investigation Division headquarters. It's a massive concrete hulk. It's a bunker with massive underground bits to it. And we were taken into this underground bit, which was corridors full of cells, and you could see other people who've been detained sort of slumped in chairs and stuff like that as you walk past open doors of these interrogation cells. And each of us were put in one of those cells separately, and we were interrogated off and on until about 1 a.m. We had hardly anything to eat, and we were very worn out. I guess I can only speak for myself. At the time, I didn't know Ying's condition. I was very worn out. All my joints were seizing up, and I was in a state of trauma. And around 1 a.m., they presented a chit saying, our bosses, our Lingbao, want us to detain you for a day or so. You've got to come with us. And they didn't tell me where they were going to take us. I had no idea that the next place would be, what it was, and the place after that would be what it was. It was a total mystery tour. And they actually took us to a police hospital.
Okay.
Called the Andar Hospital in the outlying area of Shanghai, where rudimentary medical checks were run on us, and we then had to pay for that. And our phones were ringing all the time, and we weren't allowed to answer them while that whole day was going on.
At this point in the process, did you have some hope that this could be over in a day or two?
Well, I kept on hoping this is just a one day thing. We've not done anything wrong.
Sure.
We've not broken any laws, but I realized that they'd been looking at the GSK case. Right? So at this hospital, they did an x-ray, they took a bit of blood and so forth. This was just kind of tick the box stuff. And then as we were leaving that little hospital, one of the policemen, as I was just about to get into the police car, one of the policemen said to me, hold on a minute. And he pulled out a pair of handcuffs and said, I'm sorry, I have to do this. It's because of GSK. Okay. And he put the cuffs on me. And at that moment in time, I really fell another 300 meters down the mountain. And I made sure I got his name later on. They drove us to this Shanghai Detention Center, which is off of Hunan Road in Pudong at that time. It may have moved now. And I didn't realize that that's where we were going until we got there. The mystery ride continued. And then we arrive at this kind of fortress-like gate. And they take me into this check-in area, where basically, they start strip searching you, taking and making sure that there's nothing left on your person. They document whatever items they've taken off you. And they get you to strip down almost naked, and put one of these orange vests on and they do the prison photo on you. I just couldn't believe they weren't going to let me know after they'd done, let me go after I'd done that. I couldn't believe that they were not going to let me go after that. That's how dumb I was at that moment in time.
Well, I don't think you were dumb. You were in denial. I mean, you're just self-preservation.
Then I was led into the center of this complex, into the yard and then into a building. There were this typical Chinese five-story, six-story buildings that were based on Soviet architecture. Get up to, the second floor, what they would call the second floor. And I'm handed over to another officer in uniform. And I'm forced to strip naked, you know, and he's checking my ass for any hidden secret weapons and stuff. And then he throws me a pair of tatty cotton slippers and a pair of tatty boxer shorts and makes me walk down this corridor with him. And he opens a door and there are bars, because at night time they've got this wood, grey wooden covering door over the bars of the door. So there's a barred door. Clank, clank, clank. He opens it. He shoves me in. Makes me put my hands back through the bars to remove the handcuffs. And I turn around and there's this, you know, cell, brightly lit cell, and a whole heap of little pink mounds on the floor of this cell, which are basically, you know, tatty pink quilts. And then heads start popping out from underneath these quilts, mostly shaved heads, sort of Chinese-looking heads. And basically, there I am. I've been thrown in a cell with 12 other prisoners. And I'm in a total state of shock, trauma, and disbelief, you know, calling out to God for help until God doesn't come, you know. So that's how it began.
How big was the cell?
The cells there were in the Shanghai Detention Center. The cells were about 15 square meters in floor area. And this floor was basically rough wooden boards. And the walls were concrete that had been whitewashed, and a lot of the whitewash was peeling off, and the ceilings were peeling. Ceilings were quite high. And so you couldn't reach the lights in the ceiling. And in the corner of the room was a hole in the floor type of toilet hole. And there was evidently kind of like a chief prisoner in the cell.
Yeah, there's always somebody in charge in that cell, right?
I didn't get to understand that until later. But one of the prisoners came over and said, you sleep there. And there was right next to the toilet, of course. Uh-huh. Which is where the new guy always has to sleep, next to the toilet, right? So that was the arrival, and it's hard talking about this because it's a very traumatic moment. It's a very traumatic image that remains deeply ingrained in my head, and I suffer PTSD. I've been in and out of PTSD treatment for the last 5 years, and that's one of the high point moments where it's really hard to escape from it.
Are you getting any help with it? Are you getting any relief? Does it fade at all? Is it still?
No, not really. So I'm. It's hard to help yourself or something like that. Funnily, I'm able to help other people.
That you can't talk about some of these things. We totally understand. You know, just share what you can, and people understand that. At the end of the day, I don't want to skip to the end. You know, I know you're calling out for God, and you don't think God comes, or he does or he doesn't. But I'll tell you who doesn't come is the United States government or the Canadian government or the British government. None of them really helped you in the end, did they?
You know, our governments, mine being British and my wife being the American government, provided a good nanny and messenger service. You know, the people from the consulate would visit from time to time, and they would bring messages from family and reading material. And during this detention center period, they would also be allowed to bring clothing.
Okay.
Not food. So, you know, they did provide that support, but they limit their support to imprisoned citizens. They limit it to what they call welfare and lobbying for your health and welfare, right? That's the limit. They always say to you, when if you raise a question or a complaint about why you've been detained and stuff like that, they'll just say to you, we're not allowed to intervene in the case, right? Which is insane, right? And this is a problem with all the families who I now mentor. You know, it is insane because it's all very well to say that, and I could accept that when you're talking about one of your citizens who's been imprisoned in a country that has the rule of law and which has fair and transparent trials and so forth, which allows proper defense and so on. Right. So if an American is detained in Germany or a Brit is detained in Sweden, right, we shouldn't intervene because those countries have similar judicial standards to us.
Independent courts.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But that's not what China is. No. You know, China is under a kind of fascist dictatorship called the Chinese Communist Party. And there is no rule of law. It's only the rule of the party. The party is above the law. And there's no separation of the judiciary, the prosecution, the police, and so forth. They're all controlled by the same kennel, Communist Party kennel. And nobody has a chance. So I think it's insane that, you know, the American government, the British government, and other Western governments take the view we cannot intervene in the case. This is nonsense. This is nonsense. And you have to see this in the context that among the many millions of prisoners in China today, Chinese and foreign, and regardless what kind of facility they're in, whether they're in pretrial detention or they're among the many millions who are in actual prisons as convicts, or among the millions who are in the camps in Xinjiang, there is not a single prisoner in China today who has ever undergone a fair and transparent trial. So I think it is insane to say we cannot intervene in the case. And that was how I felt when I was a prisoner. And it's how I feel today when I hear some terrible stories from families, American families, European families, about loved ones who have been locked up, not given the chance to have a fair and transparent trial.
Peter, who notified, like, the embassy? I think your son was in China with you. Who notified your son? Like, how did they know that you got locked up?
It took quite a few days. Our son was in Hong Kong at the time. He had just finished high school and he had just started a kind of internship at a cold supply chain company in Hong Kong. And we just disappeared. You know, we went off radar and he couldn't find us. And over a period of a few days, he was panicking. And his boss eventually put two and two together and asked him if he knew which clients we'd been working for recently. And Harvey said, GSK. And the guy said, well, there you go. So then, you know, Harvey and other relatives started, you know, making the calls to embassies, consulates, and so forth.
Yeah, this is an 18-year-old kid that's dealing with this.
Yeah. And the two countries' embassies and consulates had not been made aware of anything at that point in time. It was nearly a week, I think, or 5 days before they were. We were detained. We were taken on a Wednesday morning, and it was like sometime on Monday, I think, when our consulates finally got the information.
And you're in that shit stained drunk tank that whole time with 12 other people.
Yeah,
trying to improve your position the best you can. Unhealthy. Did you get any kind of relief from anybody else in there? Were they rough on you, the other prisoners, or were they kind to you? Or, I mean, what was that like? I mean, everybody's covering their heads just from the light, right? They're under blankets. But, you know, what was that like with your relationship there?
First of all, I mean, everyone in there had obviously been new boys at some point in time. So they all knew how these things work out. Mm-hmm. So on the first morning, everyone was woken up. Right? There's this artificial bugle which plays in the yard. Do, 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 do. You know, this really ugly droning bugle thing. Everyone has to get up. And so I hadn't really slept. I was in this total daze and awful state, catatonic almost. And all of a sudden, all these pink mounds are getting up. And there's all this commotion in this small space of these 12 guys. And, you know, they're going and washing their face one by one. Each one only has maybe a minute or two at the sink. There's a very crude sink there with cold water, no hot water. And, and they're folding up all their quilts and putting them in a stack and covering this stack with a tarpaulin. And then they all start walking. I use the word circumambulating around the cell. They're all going round and round.
Like, get the circulation going, yeah.
Mice on a treadmill. They're all wearing these little flip-flops, you know, hard plastic flip-flops on their feet. So there's a clattering noise, and you can hear it going all down the corridor. Every cell is doing this right now. So it's very surreal and weird. And the cell leader was saying, you've got to get up, right? So, I get up as well. But I'm in such a daze, I just don't know what to do. And then, you know, breakfast time comes, and that involves a certain designated cellmates who've got particular tasks to do. They lay out the table, and the table consists of like four or five little towels, which they lay on the floor. So pretending that's a table, and we all have to sit in a row each side of this towel table on the floor. And then there's a serving trolley manned by prison labor, comes down the corridor and passes food in doggy bowls through the bars, and this gets passed down the line where we're all sitting. And this food is basically very gritty, dry, hard rice with grit in it. Some ancient seaweed or something like that.
Yeah. No real protein.
And a little bit of, you know, these Chinese-style pickles that have probably been pickled in caustic acid or something. Awful, absolutely awful. And I realized that, you know, the other prisoners have got various little things, comforts from some sort of shopping system that was operated if you had money in an account. And they could buy, like, you know, they could buy a preserved duck egg or something like that, or some better pickle to sort of flavor this awful rice, you know. And every meal was kind of like that and always eaten that way.
And how long were you in there?
I was in that detention center for about 14 months almost.
Eating that shit for 14 months with those people?
Yeah.
Ugh.
And, of course, throughout the period leading before the trial happened in the 13th, I was being interrogated very frequently.
Yeah.
Very repetitively.
What was that like?
So the whole, you know, the whole hardship and the duress of diet, the sanitary conditions, having to live in a cell with 12 people and no furniture, you know, no bunk beds or anything like that. It just grinds them down, grinds these detainees down. And the whole idea is that, you know, you get so ground down that you just give in to the police interrogators and confess to crimes that you didn't commit. And so that's what I endured for 13 months before the case went to trial.
You resisted that for some time. You're just like, no, I didn't do anything wrong. I mean, I have
never confessed to doing anything wrong, never. And even in court, when we went to court, both of us fought against the prosecutor and the judge.
Yeah, it's funny because in the Chinese media, they always kind of headline with your confessions, right? Like
that's absolute bullshit.
Yeah, shocker.
And you know, in the courtroom, yeah, we fought tooth and nail, but they cut a lot of that out of the trial transcript, and they didn't include it in the feeds that they were putting out to the media.
And they didn't allow foreign press in the courtroom, but they allowed Chinese press. And I guess it's said that you didn't want foreign press in the courtroom, which I find preposterous.
That's a bit of a distortion. I mean, what happened was that before the trial, the judge called us to a pre-trial meeting. And he said it was going to be held in secret. And I protested, actually behind the scenes, the diplomats protested as well. I demanded that the trial be open and transparent. Yeah. And I said, okay, if you don't want to have Western journalists in there, but have diplomats and relatives. Okay. I was trying to kind of strike a compromise. So it wasn't that I said I didn't want Western journalists in there. That's totally fabricated, that statement. Yeah. But I agreed with the judge that he could exclude Western journalists if I could have diplomats and family in there, you know, witnesses who knew us and were following us closely.
If you didn't agree to that, do you think he would have allowed it? I mean, it doesn't sound like he would have.
No, I mean.
And then you wouldn't have gotten any of it.
He wasn't going to allow me to have the full suite of openness. So I went for what I thought was most important at the time. And, you know, I wasn't in the strongest of positions, you can imagine. Yeah.
No, yeah. I don't think you were. And I'll tell you, from my position, you know, I was doing this for a living, too. You know, I had a business similar to yours. And then I see you on television one day in a orange jumpsuit, like handcuffed, so you couldn't move your, it didn't look like you could move your hands an inch apart. I almost, like, I envisioned that you were manacled from the bottom too, but you said you weren't. But you're being marched from each side in and out of the courtroom.
No, it wasn't a court. Okay, so this TV incident. Okay, I was on one Saturday morning, almost 2 months after we had been detained. Police came and they told me, our Lingdao, you know, our boss, wants you to meet the media. The Chinese phrase is jie meiti, receive the media. Well, I thought, what's going on here, you know? And they said that, oh, there's been a lot of international media coverage about you, and our bosses want you to meet Chinese media. And so initially I refused, but bear in mind, I'm in the interrogation cage, right, and in handcuffs, and I'm a trapped animal. I initially refused and said I didn't want to do it. And they were pressuring me. And in the end, I said, well, look, I'll meet a few writing journalists if it helps. And no cameras, no filming. And they didn't like that. They said, oh, but no, we can blur the image. Okay. And of course, we all know very well that later on they didn't blur the image in every broadcast. And I said, no, I don't want any images at all. Okay. And they seemed to agree to that.
Yeah.
But then the following Monday morning, strange things happened. Around like 8:30 or 8 a.m., a patrol doctor who patrolled the corridors at the detention center came up to our bars and said, Peter, this is a pill for you. It will help you to sleep. Because I wasn't sleeping. And within half an hour, I was feeling extremely dopey.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I never experienced such an effective sleeping aid or whatever in the rest of my time in captivity as that one. And then half an hour later, one of the warders comes to the door and throws a brand new orange vest into the room. So that's for Peter. Change your vest.
Yeah, just for the best.
Yeah. And yeah, so I replaced my very tatty, smelly, shabby vest with this brand new one. And then another, like 15 minutes later, a bunch of warders came to the door again and called me out. And they said, Peter's going to Jie Meiti, meet the media. And I was totally unprepared for this. And some of my cellmates were looking at me and said, are you sure you're going to do this? So you see that classic image of me being walked down a corridor,
yeah,
with one warder on each side of me wearing this short sleeve shirt, the summer uniform. They were senior warders. They were not investigative police. And those two senior warders were never unkind to me in the entire time that I was in that facility.
And you said, I just want to be clear, you're saying the word warders, like, you know.
Well, what we mean in England, we use the word warder to mean guards. an officer working in a prison. We don't call them guards. Yeah. So you might call them guards.
Right.
And so they led me down this corridor. There was another warder who was filming this as we went. And when we got to the end of the corridor, we turned left to go over a kind of bridge that takes you into the neighboring block, which is the interrogation block, which I was familiar with. And as we turned that corner to go into the interrogation block, I was ambushed. You know, a gang of people with cameras, including still cameras and filming cameras, TV cameras, just came out, and the flashes were pinging and all that and so forth. I was completely ambushed. This was done without my consent. And they marched me down the interrogation block and put me into a very large interrogation room, which was set up like a little tribunal. And there was a podium, and about seven or eight of the PSB officers were seated there, including a couple of those involved in my interrogations and some of their senior commanding officers. And there were a bunch of warders, officers from the detention facility in the room on their feet, and all these camera-wielding people who I hadn't consented and allowed to film me. And I was placed inside the steel cage in the middle of the cell. It was a tall cage with very thin steel bars. And so in the images of this event, you can see vertical lines behind my back. That's the back of the cage, okay? And the man who was my daily chief interrogator was there in, they're all in uniform today. Usually the PSB were in plain clothes. My chief interrogator stood at the corner of the cage, outside the cage. I was locked into this locking chair, with a locking bar, and I've got handcuffs on, and the cage door is shut.
Because you're a dangerous animal.
Yeah, dangerous animal. And you've got lenses being pushed through the gaps of the bars and so forth. And this chief interrogator's got a clipboard with him and a list of questions and a list of things he wants me to say. And so it's all been scripted.
Yeah.
One of the cameras has the logo of CCTV on it. But as far as I can see, hardly any of these so-called journalists are writing scribes. It's pretty much all cameras. Mm-hmm. And the police officer who did this, his name is Ding Zhigong. He's a inspector rank. And he read these questions and he kept repeating, because I wasn't giving the right answers. They were trying to get me to say, yeah, I broke the law, I did this, I did that, and I'm really sorry. That's what they were trying to do. And I was trying to answer and qualify things with ifs and buts and not to self-incriminate myself. I was navigating between the need to get the fuck out of that cage by satisfying them with something, and the need not to incriminate myself by falsely confessing to a crime. And this was really hard because I was drugged, as you know, and doping. And I was the trapped animal, as you say, in a cage, nowhere to run. What am I supposed to do?
Look, everybody thinks they're a tough guy until they're a trapped animal in a cage, and then and they're drugged. I mean, I would have liked to have seen you sing God Save the Queen and piss your pants and see what Ding Dong could do with that. But
I'll see if I can arrange it for you.
Yeah. Well, I'm not singing God Save the Queen. We've got the Star Spangled Banner, but I'm sure I'd handle it the same way you did. Of course. I mean, you're drugged and you're in there. And what choice do you have? None. You're going to do what Ding Zhidong or Ding Dong kind of tells you to do. And then they edit that tape. So all your qualifications and your buts and your ands and your whatever are edited out.
Yeah. I mean, they did the same thing with my wife. Okay. And a year later, they did it again without the cage, just before our trial. The objective was to completely, prejudice public opinion, sure, against us, to prejudice any possibility of a good outcome from a trial. And this first one was done before we hadn't even been indicted, We weren't indicted till the following year.
There is no good outcome for a trial. I mean, what's the conviction rate in China? 99%?
99.9%, I think. You better get it right.
Yeah, 99.9%. So, I mean...
And the success rate for appeals is about zero.
Yeah, yeah, there. That's 99.99. But I guess this was to sway foreign opinion more than domestic opinion.
No, because initially this was broadcast in Chinese on CCTV channel in China.
Yeah,
and then it was repackaged by CGTN for broadcast overseas. CGTN wasn't called CGTN then, it was called CNTV or something like that. But anyway, it's today's CGTN. So it went first to the whole Chinese nation, and then it went to the whole world.
Was that questioning that they did, was that the typical type of interrogation, or was it more severe?
Do you mean the questioning in the cage, or...?
You said that, you know, you were continually interrogated. Was that interrogation process, and again, if you can't speak on it, Peter, I understand, but like, was it just like, hey, sit down, I'm going to ask you these 100 questions 100 times, or was there
yeah, did they hit you with a phone book or a bag of oranges, or, you know, or was it
waterboarding?
Just like,
no, you know? I mean, I was never hit or beaten or physically tortured in the sense that most people understand the word torture.
Is more mental torture.
Although the actual overall conditions were torture.
Yeah.
But the interrogations which we went through, and I know it was the same for my wife after we got out, I learned her story too. These interrogations normally consisted of them getting you to restate your entire life fucking story to them, first of all. And then they would show you documents from our case files, you know, cases of work that we had done for our clients. And they had singled out things like, you know, AIC records and HUCO records and things like that, you know. And they would ask, how did you get that? You know, who provided that in this case? And I couldn't always remember, because some of these cases predated the introduction of the privacy law that they were trying to screw us up under.
Yeah.
You know, and so this went on and on and on. So it was, what they were doing was, we were arrested because of one person's grievance, right? And that became evident at some point in the interrogations, and I'll tell you about that. But they were also trying to build this massive statistic around our case to try and suggest that we'd, you know, committed millions of offences of personal information violations, that we'd made millions and millions of dollars from just buying and selling information, ignoring the fact that we were in the business of analysis and problem solving. And so we had so many interrogations, which were just about looking at extracts from our case files from our office and signing, saying, I got this from so-and-so, or, you know, that sort of thing. And then thumbprinting each bloody page. It was nonsense. The key thing was that, you know, one day in one of the interrogations, they come out with, let's call it a photo parade on paper. So they show me a sheet with 8 faces on it, right? And they say, which one of these is Jason Tsai? Okay, Jason Tsai was an independent consultant who had been our contractor, and he had been the person who supplied personal information about Vivian Shu. This is the only instance from our case files where they said, please identify the guy. And just before they did that, they had been showing me documents from the GSK case file, getting me to confirm where did this piece of information come from and that piece of information come from and so forth. And then they come out with this photo parade, right? And you can just see, you know, the dollar signs flashing in their eyes and the eureka moment, ooh, when I say, this one is Jason Simon. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, that is what they wanted all along from these interrogations. The rest of it is just fluff and padding, right? And this was so important for them that they then got another group of PSB officers to come in and get me to do this identification again, okay? And I think Ying was put through a similar process. And this was it, you know, this was the key thing. Just like on the day of the raid, you know, the ding, ding, ding sound came on when they found the GSK case file. And in this particular interrogation, the bells rang again when I successfully identified the photo of the guy who supplied us with Vivian Schiller's information. He was totally clear. And so I said to them, I said, how is he, by the way? I understand he's in here as well. And they looked a bit shocked. Because, you know, there's a whisper network inside the detention center, and it goes cell to cell because sometimes people get moved from one cell to another. So I knew not long after I got in there, I discovered that Jason Tsai was in there as well, right? He's the only one of our contractors who was arrested in relation to our own arrest. And I knew he was in there because I met someone in one of my first cells who had spent a bit of time with him in a cell, and he had some speculations on what it was that had upset the authorities. I don't think Jason told him everything. But anyway, after I got out, I mean, that was all confirmed because we made contact with a friend of Jason's after our release who confirmed that Jason had spent exactly the same time in captivity as we had. He'd been released around the same time, and that Jason had told him it was all because of the investigation into Vivian Schiller. So that's what it was. And so most of these investigations were stupid waste of time. If they had only just focused honestly on Vivian Schiller and our GSK work and just talked about that and nothing else, because that's really all the only reason for arresting us, I could have saved them a lot of time. And I also, you know, would have had very focused and persuasive arguments to deal with that. But they just shrouded the whole thing in so much smoke and built up all these horrendous statistics of how many offences we'd committed, which were totally untrue.
So take us to the trial now. You're there. How long did your trial last?
One day.
Yeah, that's a long trial in China. Mm. Sometimes they're like 2 hours or an hour.
Or less, yeah. Well, it happened in August of 2014. Originally, it was scheduled for the day which was the anniversary of my father's death. You know, and by this time, you're kind of paranoid and you think, oh, did they do that on purpose? Then they changed it to one day later. But shortly before the trial, there was an issue surrounding Ying's brother. She had an elder brother called Bernard, and he was living in America for many years. They were very, very close as siblings. And, you know, they were the last two survivors of their family line. And in April, I was informed by my consulate that Bernard had died from a fast-acting cancer. And, you know, it was clear that he had aggravated the cancer because of all the hard work he was doing, trying to lobby for us and help us and save us. He had died, and that his widow did not want me to in any way pass this information on to Ying at that time, because the family were concerned that she might just have a nervous breakdown and not be able to handle the case very well. And I mean, this tore me, because I knew she would want to know, and I knew that she had a right to know. But, you know, basically, my sister-in-law and the family in general, the Chinese family, were insistent that Ying should not be told this immediately. And so I kept it secret. By that time, we were writing to each other intermittently through a very difficult system. They allowed us to do that after 6 months in captivity. So by this time we were writing to each other, and I had to refrain from mentioning this, the death of her brother. But then a week or two before the trial, one of the police officers told me that Ying had been informed now about her brother's death. And so I was just kind of imagining every day before the trial, I was imagining, you know, what this could have done to her, you know, how devastated she be. And on the morning of the trial, you know, we were taken separately. We didn't see each other en route to the court. We were taken separately to the court. And while I was being escorted through the court building, I passed a staircase I was at the bottom of the staircase, and I looked up and I saw Ying being led along the corridor just up the top of the stairs. And she kind of turned and said, "Good morning, Peter." And then I said, "I'm terribly sorry about your brother." And she just kind of exploded, you know, "What?
Oh, no."
And I said, "Well, he's gone. They told me you knew."
Oh, no.
And she didn't know. She flew into a rage. She started shouting, "Murderers!" And I said, "Don't blame these officers. It is. They're all killers." She's screaming. You know? And so that's how our day at the courthouse began, on a very bad note. And eventually, you know, when I was taken into the courtroom, made to sit in the courtroom. And a few minutes later, the doors flew open, and she appeared in the door with bailiffs on each side of her, and she broke loose from them because they'd been holding her up, and she ran across the center of the courtroom to her defendant's seat and just sat down, and these officers were chasing after her. I guess they thought she was going to kill the judge or something. It was a hysterical entry into the courtroom, and then she shouted at the judge, "I've just been told that my brother has died." Yeah, that's how it began.
There's meeting Ying and sitting with her for a while at dinner, and it's not long before you really develop a respect for like a quiet strength that she has.
Absolutely.
I should say that, you know, she comes from a very good Chinese family, a family of intellectuals, a family of scholars. You know, her father, who died in 2003, her father was the head of nuclear physics at Peking University.
Wow.
For decades. You know, and her mother was professor of petrochemistry. She was a professor of chemistry at the Petroleum Institute, which is another senior academic.
Probably not that well thought of by Maoists.
Well, they were treated very badly because they had both obtained their PhDs in America in the 1940s, and then they went back to China like many patriotic scholars did in 1951 to help build the motherland, as they say. And of course, they were all tricked into going back. As soon as they got back, China wanted their scientific knowledge and skills, but it persecuted the hell out of them and treated them as though they were suspect American spies and so forth. So every time there was one of those political, rectification or a purge and stuff like that, her parents were always picked on, victimized. And, they didn't deserve it. They were patriotic intellectuals. Her mother was even, an ideological communist as a young person. Mm-hmm. She wasn't by the time she died, but Ying came from a long tradition of scholarship, and her brother also was a doctoral level, a PhD in astrophysics. They were aristocrats in a way in Chinese society in a certain sense, but they were treated very, very badly.
Well, I mean, and they were intellectuals in a society that that may have valued intellectuals, but not intellectuals that had independent thinking.
That's right. That's right. So, she was from that family, and she is a very, very dignified,
yes,
scholarly individual herself. Yes. You know, she lost a lot of her education during the Cultural Revolution, and she's made it all up through self-education since then. And she's very, very scholarly, dignified, musical, and so forth. Everything that most of the people we met during this ordeal were not. When I say most of the people I met, I'm talking about the very, very low cultural level of police officers and prosecutors and judges and so forth. They're people with very low level of education.
Well, she was eventually in everywhere she went too. Not to get off you, because we're getting to your kind of final destination in China, and she had one too. And she had told me a story how she became so really appreciated by the people she was spending time with, if you will, as the way we put it, including the guards, that at one point one of the warders had asked her, "What do you want? What can I do for you?" And I think she said a banana, right? Or something to that effect. Because you couldn't get fresh fruit like that. And that guard brought in a banana for her, which was a real treat. Was it a banana or was it an apple? Or what was it?
I think it was either a banana or a couple of sachets of coffee or something like that.
No, it was a piece of fruit. It was the banana. Yeah.
And it would have been maybe around her birthday or something like that.
Yeah, and it was because of all the help that she would give people and the strength that she would give them.
Ying is very fair to our captors and jailers. Mm-hmm. And by that I mean the officers in the detention center and in her prison, women's prison. She's fair. You know, there were good guys and bad guys. And, you know, if she was writing about this, she would describe both categories. And, you know, I would say the same. You know, I did encounter some good officers in the detention center, as well as some nasty ones, and in the prison. Although I was victimized constantly, daily and hourly, by several particular officers, there were some who were reasonable.
Well, was that in the prison that you were victimized? And how were you victimized?
Yeah. Well, each cell in the prison after our trial, each cell has an officer in charge assigned to the cell. So that officer is the one who comes and does the role.
And this is now in the prison in Shanghai?
Yes. In my case, it's in Qingpu Prison. In Ying's case, it's in the Shanghai Women's Prison in Songjiang.
And in that cell and in that prison, how many people are in that cell and that prison size? And how big is it?
Similar number. It's 12 bunks per cell.
And then you had bunks at that point, so once you went to prison?
We had two-tier bunks, yeah.
Okay. And in that prison as well, there's a prisoner that's in charge of the cell.
There is a cell leader, we call it, yeah.
Right.
In my case, my first cell in Qingpu Prison, the cell leader was a Nigerian gangster.
Mm. Wonderful. Not necessarily the credit card scam kind, the kind that will maybe kill you.
No, he was the heroin smuggling kind.
Yeah, okay, so the kind that will kill you. Yeah, so for all these people that think they're going to go in the cell and automatically become the leader of the cell, which, you know, of course, I would think that, remembering who I was, not who I am today, you, as Peter pointed out to me, will get sorted quickly.
That's right. I think that the key thing about those officers I mentioned is that, you know, I had not pleaded guilty or confessed to any crime. You know, contrary to this false and forced TV appearance, and contrary to the Chinese reporting about the trial, neither of us had pleaded guilty or confessed to any crime. And when we arrived in the prison, you know, the prison's job, first of all, is to crush the prisoner even further and get them to write a written confession of guilt and a repentance report, called, and to get them to write and rewrite these again and again and again every week. And I refused to do it. And I knew at that point, you know, how long my sentence was limited to. You know, I was sentenced to 2.5 years, right? And so I just refused. I mean, prisoners in there with long sentences would comply with this stuff and would falsely confess to crimes they hadn't committed even in order just to reduce their sentence through merit points and get out of there a bit sooner. But I refused. And so there was one particular, you know, cell captain, we call them captains in Chinese prisons. That's what the officers are called. Mm-hmm. Everyone is called a captain. Captain Wei was in charge of my cell. He was assigned to the cell because I was in the cell. His assignment was to be hard on me. Every day when I might be out sort of in the common room, there's a sort of activity room where we eat our meals and where forced manufacturing labor was also carried out between meals. I might be in there, right, or I might have been taken to meet an officer and have a conversation. I would come back and find that Captain Wei had been into the cell and had tossed out all my belongings, a few belongings I have from my drawer and from my overhead cupboard, just toss them all around the room, things like that. And a key thing for me was I needed medical attention because I knew I had a prostate problem and possibly prostate cancer. And they had been withholding that, the necessary investigations and so forth, while I was in the detention center, and my symptoms were getting worse and worse.
And you did end up having prostate cancer.
Yeah, I was released, it was diagnosed properly.
Well, they could have figured that out very, very quickly from that initial.
Yeah. They didn't want to.
Initial hospital visit you had on day one where they took your blood. A simple PSA could have done it.
Doing any real testing. And Captain Way, every time I asked to be taken to see a doctor or a clinic and get this investigated, Captain Way and his superior, Captain Jarl, would say that you haven't signed the confession.
Motherfucker. Right.
So basically, they were playing me like that, using my health as an instrument of extortion to extort a false confession from me.
And you still didn't do it.
And I refused. And so I never got seen properly until the 21st month. I finally managed to get, with some more lobbying from my consulate and embassy, I managed to get an MRI. And sure enough, it found a tumor. Right. And so I then managed to notify my son during one of my allocated telephone calls from the prison you are allowed in theory to call home. Eventually, over the next few weeks, I could sense things were moving and that they were going to try and get me out of there because this was a serious risk for them. But Captain Way was a key figure in all of this activity. During the winter, he took away my warm clothes. Another prisoner managed to get something for me and then he took that away from me. Things like that he was doing. I responded also by trying to play off his politics, to play him off against other officers in our cell block. And towards the end, it was working so thoroughly that he was getting really, really upset. And they basically separated him from me and they put me into what we called the sub brigade, which is like a sub block of our block, separately run. And far fewer prisoners in it, foreigners. So towards the end, I was separated from Captain Way because I had complained about him and he was really pissed off.
Do you ever dream about smashing his face in?
I don't know about that. I would just like to see him face justice,
That's what I just said.
Yeah.
that's
what I think I said anyway. I just don't. How you could not dream about having the tables turned in some way where you would.
Yeah, what a dick.
And I wonder, in the better sense of you, maybe if he knew the tables were turned and you treat him like a human and say, this is how it should be done. But what you did was inhuman. It was inhuman.
Mm. And, I have contact with ex-prisoners when they get released from Chengdu. I try to track down people who've been released and interview them to kind of get updates on the situation in the prison. And, I've got a number of letters that have been smuggled out.
And he's still there, Captain Way?
Yeah, he's still there. He's been promoted. He's okay. In charge of the brigade. He's in charge of the block.
Yeah, well, now we're on to something. Do we know where he lives?
Yeah.
I'm just saying. Just whisper it to me. Nobody's listening. All right. Well, I mean, that is and the fact that all the tragedies that you've talked about up to and including like right before the court case that you had to see your wife and go through that with her about her brother, you start to realize that you're having a medical condition. You do. It's a serious medical condition. And then it got, even after you were released, it had to get worse because it wasn't treated early. And really, I mean, I don't know how you couldn't somehow feel that, again, the medical condition goes back to GSK and the job you took. Not only, how you were treated in prison, but this whole thing changed the trajectory of your life, your wife's life, your son's life. And to this day, you maintain and believe wholeheartedly you did nothing wrong.
That's correct. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think, you know, I think I may have told you before that, you know, obviously I went into my China experience 46 years ago, being very fascinated and interested of Chinese culture. And over these years, you know, I've made hundreds, if not thousands, of Chinese acquaintances and friends, and not to mention the family. And you know, so I'm somebody who went into that 46 years ago, a guy who loved China in a way. Mm-hmm. And it's important to say that I still do love China. But unfortunately, you know, China is now ruled by a regime that is no longer opening up and reaching out. It is now ruled by a regime which is impossible to love. And that's the regime that did this to me and my family, who just destroyed our lives, destroyed our business, orphaned our son for 2 years and so forth, ruined his career plans as well. You can't stop loving the things that you loved about China because of this.
You can love China and her people.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
absolutely.
You know, I'm all for that. I certainly love her people. Yeah, this regime, the PRC government, and I'll say it, President Xi, you know, is a dictator. Winnie the Pooh. So and now that you're here in the United States, or you're in UK and I'm here in the United States, like, look, they spy on us here. They tap our phones here. Their reach has gotten even bigger, more vast and more dangerous. And if there aren't people like you talking about it, then it's just going to, you know, and affect other people's lives more quickly. And I think we should say that people should understand there's some happy parts of this in the end. I mean, Harvey's doing very well. Your son obviously raised very well and very successful. And to the extent that you and Ying are getting on with your lives, how is that going? I know it doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of humor going on. I hope you can find more of it, because that's a medical remedy for a lot of things.
Well, you know, we don't have any employment. We don't have a business, and we're not going back to either of those situations. We basically live on our retirement savings, and I spend a lot of my time commenting on China. I provide sound bites to the media. I also occasionally write articles myself, and I'm very active in efforts to discredit Chinese television for its role in extracting and packaging and broadcasting forced confessions. This year, I successfully managed to get the UK regulator to remove the broadcasting license of CGTN in the UK.
Yeah, sanction them. Yeah.
And I'm now working with others to achieve the same thing in other parts of the world. So I'm kind of a bit of an activist. And, you know, I've toyed with the idea of writing a book. And we're not quite there yet. But I've also spent time litigating against GSK. And over the last 2 years, I've found myself increasingly being approached and drawn into relationships with families around the world who have somebody today in a position similar to the position we were in when we were behind bars. And so I provide them with practical hand-holding advice on how to handle the situation, how to make life behind bars easier for their family member, sharing contacts and, you know, doing some lobbying. When I was visiting the US recently, I was lobbying one of the congressional committees, and very, very, very good result, where it ended up with a couple of your legislators lobbying the Federal Communications Commission with regard to the CGTN situation. So those are the things that occupy me. And Ying occupies herself mostly with research on her family's history, going right back into the late Qing dynasty, with the aim of eventually writing a book about her family's history and using that story to reflect the history of modern China over the last century or so.
Interesting.
And I think that's a very promising project. She's full of enthusiasm for it. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, she's been relearning the violin, which she learned when she's a child. So between 6 and 7 p.m., I get a free concert, violin music wafting down the stairs.
I bet she's already very good.
And when she's finished her session, she comes down the staircase singing.
Oh, well, that's something else. And then she makes you a bowl of fruit every night.
She cuts fruit after our dinner every night. Yeah.
Well, look, I find some little joys and pleasures. I know that's easy for me to say. You know, I'm not a religious man, and you know, I know at some point you kind of reached out and said, "Where's God to help me?" But you know, it sure seems like there's a hand in helping others. What you're doing right now is kind of God's work, right? Mm-hmm. You know, these families have nobody to turn to. And then when you're there to give practical advice, that sure seems like, you know, that's a very healthy thing and a very godly thing to do. I certainly appreciate it. You know, I don't ever plan on going to China. I'm not sure that would be well received, but if I did, I'd love to have you in my corner. And I'm glad you're helping these people. I've heard of the work you've done there, and that's gotta really be a godsend to these families.
And I think the wheel is turning. I mean, you know, Enos Kanter speaks out. There was Women's Tennis Association over Peng Shua, who had her forced confession on TV about the alleged rape. I think, and hopefully it's not too late, I think that people are starting to wake up a little bit and notice.
Yeah, I think it's too late, but I'm glad that there are individuals that are putting what's left of their life back on the line, like you, Peter. So thank you for that. Is there anything you'd like to impart on us, and any advice you'd like to give, or any way you'd like people to reach out to you or read your work or follow you?
Support it.
Yeah.
All I would say at the moment is that things are not going to improve in China until there is the change at the top. And until that change happens, it will not be safe for anybody in China.
I totally agree. Any way people can follow you? Or do you want them following you?
I'm very active as a commentator on LinkedIn.
Okay, there you go, LinkedIn.
Over the last 5 years, I've had quite a lot of influence on the debate about China on the LinkedIn platform.
Let's follow Peter Humphrey on LinkedIn. I follow him on LinkedIn, and I see that he writes some great articles. I can't say I hope you enjoyed this podcast. I can say I hope you found it informative and that you follow Peter and you take it seriously. We'll be following his case, and hopefully he'll join us again as a returning champion on China issues. Peter, thank you. You've been gracious with your time, and give Ying my best.
Thank you very much. You guys stay well.
And to our listeners, thanks for listening. If you like what you heard, leave us a comment, give us a retweet, follow us on Twitter. Thanks for joining us.
I speak English.
Yo hablo español.
我讲中文.
But FCI brings us together. From document translation, interpretation, transcription, and voiceover to any of your linguistic needs, FCI helps the world communicate in one single language, yours. For customized language solutions, call 610-438-8900 or visit us at fcitle.com. FCI, the language experts, making the world connect.